Thank you, Becky, for this too wonderful of an introduction. I don't know if I deserve such a welcoming to be introduced by the president. What an honor. And it's really good to be back at Greenbelt again. You know, Greenbelt to me has become like those potato chips commercials. Once you start, you can't stop. And so I feel an addiction to Greenbelt and a real desire to always be here. It's a real blessing and honor for me to be here. So let me start by saying, as some of you know, I am not a theologian, I'm not a preacher, I'm not a politician, and I have never studied theology, and I don't know how to deal with those who study theology. Last night, I listened to Bob Bell here. I listened to every word he said. I didn't understand much of what he said, just because of the accent, but it was amazing, and I learned so much from this. But I come to you today really with a story, with my personal story. It is a story of a journey of discovery, asking questions and trying to find answers for these questions. Especially asking questions in the midst of a conflict that I and my father and my family for many years have suffered from. An occupation, a system of oppression, of human rights violations that exists in the land that we call holy. And it's not asking the questions of why is there injustice or why is there violence, but to really ask the personal question, as a person who has committed himself to following the teachings of Jesus, what is my role in the midst of conflict? What is my responsibility in the midst of conflict? I ask these questions because I think what God calls us to do is to challenge, even, I would say, and I hope you accept this from me, even for us to challenge what Jesus asks us to do. Because if I want to follow the teachings of Jesus in full acceptance, and just to say, yes, this is what it's all about and I need to follow this, then I'll find ways to justify why in this particular incident I don't follow the teachings. Like when Jesus calls us to give everything that we own to the poor and follow him. All of us can come up with excuses and justifications why I just cannot do that, or I cannot give everything, or I cannot fully engage in this teaching. And when Jesus asks me as a Palestinian, as his follower, to love the enemy, I can come up with every reason and every excuse why I should not love the enemy. Because what the enemy is doing to me, what the occupation is doing to me, how the enemy is suppressing me. So for me, part of questioning the teaching allows for me to look deep within myself, to check within myself, am I truly committed to following the teachings of this person? And then if I'm truly committed to doing that, what does that mean for me in my life? And of course, what I've been asked to talk about today, which is really the question of all questions in terms of how I live, what does it mean when Jesus calls us in Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, to love the enemy? Can I truly love those who are doing violence towards me? And I want to challenge everyone here today not to look at this just as what those Palestinians and those Israelis are doing. I want to challenge everyone here, as we have this conversation together, to look deep into themselves. Who have you labeled as your enemy? And how are you loving those who you have labeled as your enemy? Is it the neighbor who parks his car in front of your house? Is it the driver who cut you off in the street? Is it a group of people that look differently than you, act differently than you? Is it even a group of people that have even committed an act of violence towards your group of people that you have labeled as an enemy? Because I think the challenge for us is that, again, if we have this commitment to follow this person and his teachings, it is really living out this commitment fully in our life. But before I talk more into this understanding of loving the enemy, I want to give you my personal story, my context of what led me to look into this question in the deepest possible way, and not just to overlook at it or justify it, why I cannot do that. My story, as I mentioned, is I come from a Palestinian background. I come from also what is known as a refugee background. Many of you know in 1948, the war that happened in what was known as historic Palestine. In 1948, my father's family lived in Jerusalem. It was a neighborhood right outside the old city. During the war, my grandfather was killed in the war. He wasn't killed as a combat soldier. He was actually killed as a civilian who was trying to protect his family by raising a white flag on top of his house. He was shot by a sniper. My father was 9 years old at that time. Him and his siblings, the oldest was 12, pulled the body of their father and buried him in the courtyard of the house. The tragedy for the family did not just end with the death of the grandfather or the father. A few days later, the Jewish forces took over that neighborhood and demanded that all non-Jews leave their homes, be evicted. So my grandmother and 7 children became refugees, part of the mass population of 800,000 Palestinians who were displaced from their homes in 1948. They moved to Bethlehem because my grandmother had a brother that lived there, and she couldn't take care of her children. The only option for her was to send her children to orphan homes. So imagine a family that lost the father, lost the home that they owned in an upper middle class neighborhood in Jerusalem, lost their income, lost their possessions, lost the private schools that children used to go to, everything. She only had an ability to take a bag full of clothes with her when she left her home. Becoming refugees, living in orphan homes, completely divided and separated from each other. This is the story of the family that I grew up in. A story that has every right and excuse and justification, not just to hate those who did this to us, but to actually seek revenge and retaliation. Most people will actually accept that reaction to something like this happening to the family. And this is, of course, happens all over the world. Jumping to my personal story is I grew up all of my life under occupation, what is known as the Israeli military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, Palestinian territories, and so on. Every day of my life growing up, every single experience I had with Israelis was one where there was violence, oppression, insult, attack, demonizing from them towards us. My father was principal of an orphanage. It wasn't strange to have soldiers raid the orphanage for absolutely no reason, just to provoke confrontation with the children of the orphanage. Numerous times as a child, I would ride with my father carrying injured school children from the orphanage to hospitals, children 14, 15, 16 years old who were shot by soldiers or by what are known as settlers. If you asked me as a child to define an Israeli, it was very simple. Any Israeli for me was a soldier and a settler who had a gun, who hated us, who was violent towards us, and wanted to kill us. Even then, we used to be able to travel freely. There were no checkpoints and there was no wall built. So for us, it was easy to actually go to cities like Tel Aviv and Haifa and Herzliya and Nahariya, all of these cities and towns in Israel. And we would go and swim in the beaches in these cities. But for me, sitting next to a family of Israelis sitting swimming there, I would look at them as soldiers and settlers on vacation. That's who every single Israeli was to me. And I grew up hatred, with a lot of hatred towards those who were doing these actions towards me. But at the same time, I grew up in a family that understood our faith to mean a faith where revenge and retaliation was not an option for us. My grandmother, who lost everything she possessed, including her husband, always insisted on us as a family that revenge and retaliation is not an option, but seeking peace and reconciliation was the option that we need to engage in. And I was very challenged by this as a child. How can I make peace with them when they are doing everything they're doing to us? Arguing with my father at a young age. How dare you even ask us to make peace with them? Look how they're treating you even. And when I mean you, I mean seeing my father verbally abused numerous times by Israeli soldiers who were just a few years older than me. And my father couldn't do anything about it. How do we make peace with them, let alone loving them? That is the challenge. That is the question. That is the question I grew up in. I was very lucky at an early age to have an uncle of mine who came to Jerusalem. He lived in the U.S., came to Jerusalem and opened a center to teach nonviolence to the Palestinian community. He studied what Gandhi did in India, Martin Luther King did in the U.S., and opened a center called the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence. And from a young age, I started participating in many of the activities that my uncle was organizing. Protests, demonstrations, planting trees in lands that were going to be confiscated by the Israeli settlers. All kinds of activities that were very empowering, that made me feel, finally, I'm able to do something. I'm able to stand up in the face of this occupation. At the same time, not engaging in violence, which was the message of the family, but do something to end this injustice. Two things happened in my work with my uncle. The first thing was my stereotype of Israeli society broke when I met Israelis who were neither soldiers or settlers. Israeli peace activists. And not just peace activists in the sense of let's find a way to all get along and be quiet and end conflict. But peace activists who understood the injustice that was happening to the Palestinians by their own government and their own military and were ready to stand with us. Not just solidarity, not just sympathy, but on the front lines of resisting the occupation. And that was very important for me in my process, to begin to understand the enemy. That there is more within the enemy than just what I had experienced. The second big thing that happened was when the Israeli army arrested my uncle and actually deported him, kicked him out from the land, specifically because of his work in nonviolence. A peaceful activist of nonviolence was seen as a threat to the national security of Israel, and for that reason, he was deported. It was at that moment that I decided this is what I want to commit my life for. What was so powerful about a peace activist, a nonviolent activist that made a great, powerful country like the State of Israel see him as a threat and decide to deport him? Even until this day, he's not allowed to return and live in Palestine. And it was then that I said, I want to learn nonviolence. Of course, where is there a better place to learn about nonviolence than to go to a university in the U.S.? And that's where I ended up, studying peace and conflict resolution in an American university in Washington, D.C. What's interesting about what I learned in the U.S. is that whatever I learned there does not work. The Americans, they have a weird system in how to deal with issues. It's called the steps approach. I don't know if you know that or not. Everything for them is done in steps. You know, you want a diet? There's a 7 steps approach to dieting. You want to end conflict? There's a 6 steps approach to ending conflict. But of course, as we know, conflicts are not linear and are not straight to be done as a steps approach. So I came back with a real process of really trying to see what can I do to really end the conflict and violence we were living under. And in the year 1999, I started this organization called Holy Land Trust, which is committed to engaging in nonviolence as a means to ending the conflict. Now, if you ask me when I started the organization, and especially after the peace process collapsed in 1999 and we went into the second intifada, the second uprising, which was very violent and many people suffered from this, the violence of the second intifada. If you ask me at that time if what I was doing was nonviolent and was fulfilling God's will or following the teachings of Jesus, I would have said yes. Because for me, I put Jesus in the box of saying that he would stand with the oppressed against the oppressor. He would stand with the victim against the victimizer. He would stand with the occupied against the occupier. This is exactly what Jesus would do. And he, of course, he would do it nonviolently. And I justified every action I did that was nonviolent as an action that would fulfill God's will in my life. So I would engage in protests, demonstrations, boycott campaigns, all kinds of activities. Get beaten up, get arrested, get shot at, get wounded by the Israeli soldiers, by the Israeli settlers, all doing it nonviolently. And as I said, fully convinced that this is what Jesus was about. What I later discovered was that Jesus was not just about this. Jesus is more than just standing with the oppressed against the oppressor, with the occupied against the occupier. And for me, the turning point in my life was when, at one point, I reread the Gospels, read the Sermon on the Mount, and those 3 words that we're talking about today popped out from the Bible as if they were words that I hear for the first time. Love your enemy. And for me, it was shocking, as if I heard them for the first time. In our faith, as you know, for the Christians here, in our Christian faith, we're proud actually of having these words written in the Bible. We talk about them all the time. But read them for the first time. What does it really mean to love the enemy? What is Jesus asking me to do when I read these words? Does he want me to go out, you know, find the first Israeli soldiers on a checkpoint, open my arms out, say, come on, I love you, man. You know, give me a hug. You know you want it. Is this what loving the enemy is? What is the message of Jesus? And for me, it took me on a journey. And this journey is still what I live until this day, to really try to figure out what loving the enemy means. For me, there were 2 important components of understanding what it means to love the enemy. The first is, what do I have to do within myself as a person? And the second is, what do I have to do in terms of my relationship with those who I have labeled as an enemy? Justified or not, they are the enemy component. So it's not just in terms of the relationship itself. It's what do I need to do within myself. And I would like to share just a few points of my personal journey on what is needed within yourself to understand what it means to love the enemy. The first point that came to my mind is to determine my identity. Well, it's easy. You're a Palestinian. Well, I had to really ask this question. Who am I really? Now, each one of us, as you know, we carry multiple identities. You carry an identity of being a Christian, a Muslim, a Brit, an Englishman, a Welsh, Irish, from wherever community you come from, whatever groups you're affiliated with, political parties. So each one of us carries multiple identities. The challenge is not to deny all of these identities, but to ask myself, what is the identity that covers all of these identities, that encompasses all of these identities into one? The moment I label myself and say my Palestinian identity trumps every other identity, I allow then for any other identity that challenges my Palestinian identity to become an enemy, an animosity to me. So for me, it was very important to understand that part of my own personal process, in order for me to love the enemy, was for me to declare within myself a greater identity than just the political, cultural identity that I was born in and grew up in. An identity to say, I am a follower of Jesus. I am a follower of God. Not even a Christian identity. That human identity that encompasses all humanity and all identities. And the moment you declare yourself in that greater identity, you begin to see identities different as well. Where my lenses do not look at the Israelis simply as the enemy to the Palestinian, but how do I relate to the Israeli, to the settler, from that greater consciousness of having that deeper identity, that human identity, which I believe is the greatest message of Jesus that he gave to us. The second thing that I went through to understand also how to love the enemy was to create a distinction within myself to understand how much within me the past affects the decisions I make in the present for the future. And this is very important because part of how we are created as human beings, especially in our physical creation, we are created with instinct in us. Which means we learn from the past and experiences that we have had or others have had in the past, and for that we decide the steps we take for the future. For example, I know many people did not come to Greenbelt this year because of what happened last year with the rain. Their past told them, you're crazy if you come again. The reason I came to Greenbelt this year because a few years ago it was beautiful and I had a great time. That made me decide. And if you look in your life, any decision you make for the future is mostly affiliated with experiences you've had in the past. Now, this is where our physical instinct takes over, and we allow our spiritual presence, which is our creation in vision, in light, in future, to be overtaken by this instinctual desire in us. So for me, it's very important to create this distinction where I say, yes, I honor the past, I learn from the past, I respect the past, but am I going to allow the past to determine the future that I seek? Because if I allow the past to determine the future, it limits me to almost a dead end. The past that I have experienced with Israelis tells me there is no future. If we really want to seek understanding, loving the enemy, it is about creating a future, which is again what Jesus tells us to do, create a future that is independent from the past and allow that future to be lived in the presence. Allow the kingdom of God to be at hand today. Another very important step in my process was to create a distinction, the third point, to create a distinction between what is fact and what is my interpretation of the fact. It's easy for me as a Palestinian to come up here and say, all Israelis are this, or the Israelis have done this to us. Of course, you'll hear an Israeli say, all Palestinians are this. And you can listen to the language that's spoken here in your country. All Muslims are like this. All Arabs are like this. How we generalize instead of looking at facts. What happened? What are the facts that happened? Not my interpretation, not my opinion, not my stereotyping, not my generalization. What is the fact that happened? And how do I just deal and address the fact? Instead of saying Israelis attacked a place in Palestine, how do I look at the fact and say, yes, there was an attack and there was violence, but it was done by a group of Israelis that did this action? This is related to the next point. Part of my ability to learn to love the enemy was my process of freeing myself from the mindset and the consciousness of victimization that lives within me. The moment I'm able to free myself from my declaration of myself as a victim to that circumstance, it opens up a whole new opportunity to deal with the conflict, to deal with the occupation, even to deal with somebody who is violent to me. If I put myself continuously in the place of victimization, I am the victim of the other. I am a victim of the circumstances. I'm a victim of that situation. I'm a victim of that perpetrator. What are the options that are available to me? Part of liberating myself from victimization is also to follow the teachings of Jesus, which calls us to liberate ourselves from judging the other. How often do we again judge the other for what they do to us? And we live continuously in that past of judgment and counter-judgment and who's at fault and who started it. And how do we seek that liberation? So it starts on this personal process of transformation. In order for me to have the strength to love the enemy, I need to liberate myself from everything that prevents me from loving the enemy. Now the challenge is, how do I deal with the enemy? Knowing all of this, having gone through this process, or going through this process at this time. When God calls us to love the enemy, or when Jesus calls us to love the enemy, it was very interesting for me, because the point that I found is that, first thing, he does not give me a choice in this. Okay? Jesus does not tell me, Sammy, I would like for you to consider loving your enemy. Or, Sammy, I hope one day you will reach the point of loving the enemy. It is a commandment. A clear commandment. There is no weaving and turning around this. This is the first point. The second point, what's important, is that Jesus, if we look at the context of the conflict that he lived in at that time, he could have easily said, I call you, as the Jewish people living under occupation of the Romans, to resolve your conflict with your enemy. And he would have been as rejected for making such a statement as saying to the Jewish people, love your enemy. He could have said, I call you to make peace with your enemy. I call you to sign a peace agreement with your enemy. And people would have rebelled against him for saying these things. These were revolutionary statements at that time, understanding the context of the suffering and occupation the Jews were living under. Jesus crosses all of these steps. He's not calling us to resolve the conflict. He's not calling us to end the conflict. He's not calling us to sign a peace agreement with the enemy. He is calling us to love the enemy beyond anything that actually physically or mentally can be accepted in the context of conflict. So what does that mean? What does it mean to love the enemy? The first point, which is very important, is to know who your enemy is. If I want to resolve a conflict with a person, I can resolve a conflict, I can sign a treaty, an agreement, and each will go his own way. And we see this in the Middle East. Egypt and Israel, Jordan and Israel signed these peace agreements. We've signed numerous peace agreements in the Middle East. Is there peace? There isn't. Because we signed these agreements, and what happens, yes, there's an end to violence as an expression, but animosity and hatred and ill feeling continue. So the first point, Jesus calls us to know the enemy. If I want to love somebody, I have to know them. When I first saw this beautiful woman walking in Bethlehem, of course, I fell in love with her. But true love means building a relationship, a long-term relationship with that person or that community. And for me to be able to marry this woman and build a long-term relationship with her, I had to get to know her so that this love can be a lasting love. So for me, the question is, the challenge is to look into the Israeli society and ask, who is my enemy? If God created all of us as equal, if God created each one of us in His image, what has allowed for that community or that group of people or that individual to become who they have become? We need to understand, and many people don't like to have this conversation because we think that if we understand the story behind their action, then we justify or excuse what they're doing to us. If we ask, what is the reason behind the people who committed 9/11, that means we're justifying or excusing terrorism or terror attacks. This is not the Christian way. We need to find out who the enemy is. Jesus went to the Samaritans. It's interesting, if you read the Bible, the story of Jesus speaking to the Samaritan woman. The Bible actually says He had to go through Samaria. He didn't have to go through there, because most Jews never went through Samaria to go from Galilee to Jerusalem. Jesus went to the enemy to find out who the enemy is and to hear the story of the enemy. For me, it was very important in my personal process to find out who the enemy is. Because one thing I didn't mention purposely was that neighborhood that my father lived in before 1948 had Christians, Muslims, and Jews live in it in peace before the war began. So is my enemy Judaism? Is my enemy the Jewish people? Is my enemy the Israelis? Or is my enemy something that happened in that history that allowed for this community to go from a community that was ready and willing and engaged in living peacefully with their neighbors to becoming a community that has engaged in racism, discrimination, and ethnic cleansing towards the Palestinians? And where I learned who my enemy was when I was invited by actually Jewish friends of mine to go with them on a retreat to the death camps of Auschwitz and Birkenau in Poland. I don't know if any of you have been there. But for me, it wasn't in Jerusalem or in Bethlehem or in the land of Palestine that I discovered the narrative of my enemy. It was in this cold Polish town, the death camps, where I saw who my enemy is. It was those who did not just survive the Holocaust, but who came out traumatized by the Holocaust, creating a mindset that we will never allow this to happen again. Even though those who survived the Holocaust, they were talking about not allowing this to happen to anybody. But of course, generation after generation, it's become never allow this to happen again to us. And we will do whatever is necessary to prevent this from happening again. For me, it changed my whole paradigm, even as a person who grew up living in this conflict, when I was able to see who my enemy is. For me, it was so important, for example, when I was in Auschwitz, not just to hear the stories of what happened in the past, but being there and hearing how the message of the Holocaust is taught to young Israeli children, 13 to 16-year-old children, that the message was, this is not just our past. This is our present and our future. What happened in the Holocaust is not over. And if given an opportunity, and I heard these words, the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Muslims will do to you what the Nazis did to your ancestors. This is one of the core issues that we're dealing with. In your personal life, look at those who you have labeled as enemies. What is the story? What is the narrative behind their actions towards you? The second point, and this is what I engaged in, which is very important for us, and Jesus calls us to do this. He calls us to listen. Listen without prejudice. Listen carefully and consider carefully how you listen to others. This is what Jesus calls us to do. We need to listen. Listen to the stories. Listen to the narratives. We may not agree. Again, it could be all interpretations. It could be all opinions. But we need to create a space where we listen to the other. You have no idea how powerful listening is. I don't have any idea how powerful listening is. We always like to speak. We always like to preach. We always like to tell people what they should do. I think most of you who have come to Palestine on trips understood how powerful it is for the Palestinians when you just simply listen to them. How so much healing happens just by listening to people. For them to be able to express their wounds, their hurts, their frustrations, their anger. This is what we need to do even to those who we have labeled as the enemy. It kills me. It just really kills me when I hear politicians say things like, we have no need to listen to the other. We have no space. We have no desire to listen to the other. We will not engage in dialogue with them because they are the enemy. Not understanding the power of listening. The third point, which for me, again, is a message of how powerful Jesus engaged with us. What Jesus did was he healed. We need to heal the past. In order for us to move to the future, we need to heal the past. Healing for Jesus, when he conducted healing to the communities, to the people that he went with, was to free them from the constraints of the past. If it was physical constraints, if it was spiritual constraints, emotional constraints, healing is the means to do that. And Jesus calls us to be healers as well. Part of loving the enemy is what are we doing to bring healing to their wounds of the past. Sadly, disappointingly, we have failed to bring healing to the traumas of the past when it comes to Palestine and Israel. For both the Jewish community, for both the Palestinian community, the world has not engaged in healing, which means bringing closure, reconciliation, and forgiveness to the past. The next point related to that personal process is, what is the future that we seek to create with them? How do I enroll my enemy in a future that is worth living for? And this is very important, because in our context, we are talking about a solution. We're talking about a political solution. You hear the negotiations that are happening now. What is the future that is being created out of these political negotiations? Honestly, I will say, for most Palestinians and Israelis, there is no hope that a future is being created. What is being hoped for is a separation, not a future for peace between the communities. And Jesus calls us, again, when he calls us to live out the kingdom of God today, as the church, we are not called just to do compassion, just to do charity. We are called to live out his teachings today in the here and in the now. How are we living these conditions in our conflicts? How are you living this with the person that you have labeled as an enemy? Which could be even your relative, your child, your husband, your wife. Are you living the past? Victimization of the past? Blaming and complaining about the past? Or are you creating a future with them that is a future of liberation and freedom and love and equality? The next point is to understand that one of the most powerful teachings of the gospel is to understand that the opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is not anger. The opposite of love is not violence, but the opposite of love is fear. And this is the message from 1 John chapter 4. When he calls us, when the gospel calls us to engage in love, because love is the way we liberate ourselves and free ourselves from fear. Palestinians and Israelis both live in absolute fear from the other. Only through love can this transformation happen. And the last point is what I feel God ultimately calls us to do. When he calls us to love the enemy, what he is asking us to engage in is to, again, back to that first point of identity, which is creating a new identity of oneness in humanity. This is what love is all about. There is no Palestinian or Israeli. There is no Jew or Gentile. There is no Sunni or Shia. There is no British and French. What God calls us to engage in, what we are called as his followers, when Jesus calls us to love the enemy, it is about creating a new identity of human oneness in him that is founded in his teachings and in the values that we have all so learned for so many years. So yes, it's not easy. It really is not easy to love the enemy, because the injustice continues until this day. The question is, am I ready to engage in a new process where I'm able to create the distinctions, where I'm able to see the human side of that individual completely distinct from his actions? Where I'm able to even do as Jesus calls us to do, to rebuke the sin of the other, but not to rebuke the sinner. Where I'm able to resist the violence of the other, resist the injustice of the other, but not to demonize and dehumanize those who are committing this injustice and violence. I believe this is the challenge for all of us, not just for those who live in areas of conflict. We are called to stand for justice. We are called to stand for human rights. We are called to stand for equality in the human family. But we are called to do it through love. And for me, the big turning point in my life was when I was able to understand that the demonstrations that I used to engage in, those nonviolent protests that I told you about, even though I declared nonviolence, I declared the language of peace to my enemy, in my heart, there was a lot of hatred. And until I was able to heal that hatred from my heart, I never was able to engage in a real process of peacemaking. Thank you, and may God bless you. Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Sammy, for that. We do have 10 minutes or so for some questions. Because of the size of the venue, it's difficult to get around with almost impossible to get around with a mic. But we do have a mic set up over there on the left. So if you'd like to come down so that you can ask some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In his book, The Divided Self, Rabbi David Goldberg, who was the rabbi of the London Liberal Jewish Synagogue, he says there was a narrative that the state of Israel was created by Holocaust survivors and sanctioned by a guilty world as some kind of atonement for the Holocaust. And he says, and I used to write saying that, you know, in books and articles, and now I'm saying that's not true. That's a false narrative, you know, that it was set up by other people. The first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, was not a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. He was embarrassed by the presence of Holocaust survivors. They were the wrong kind of Jew, not the fighting Jew. You know, they were the dust of humanity, he called them. And I wondered, when you were talking about the identity that we take to ourselves in relation to the other, and is there also a process of challenging the identity of the enemy?
Yes. Yeah. No, thank you. And I'll try to be short with answers to give more space. I believe yes. And I believe that we are called to do this. And we are called to create whatever mechanism that, in a sense, frees the other from what they have labeled, again, as their identity and have confined themselves. Because for me, when I look at the Jewish community, I look at a community that is shackled now by the experiences of the past and the fear and the trauma that they have experienced. So for me, I say part of the process of building these relationships of trust and respect between communities allows for this conversation to happen. Part of my engagement in nonviolent resistance is to create space for breaking the identity of victimization that exists in the other. Because the identity of the other is not just based on the past experience. It is based also on what they expect me to conduct towards them from my past experience with them. So for example, as I said, the stereotype again of the Palestinians doing this to us. Any Palestinian is seen as a threat to any Israeli Jew. How do we break that mindset is very important. And this is where nonviolent activism becomes important. The moment an Israeli begins to see me as a person who is seeking his justice, he's seeking his human rights, but is ready to commit to doing that through nonviolence, it creates a different opportunity of engaging with that other, and it begins to break their perception, which form their identity as well. So yes, again, part of the ultimate process is how do we free each from their identity of victimization that they exist in.
Hi, Sami. Nice to meet you, man. I wrote my question down because I was going to forget it. How can we communicate what I would argue is the necessity for boycott through the language of love, i.e. I love you and I want to free you from the kind of state you're in, and because of that I'm going to boycott you, that kind of thing.
Yeah. If you understand. No, it's a very good point. And as many of you know, part of what's been happening globally is a campaign called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which I believe is a very important tactic and engagement to engage in. The way I look at it is this. If you have a close friend or a relative who is doing something wrong, you do something to help them get off the path of wrong and into the path of goodness or healing and liberation. And the best way I would look at this is that if that friend of yours or that relative of yours has become even addicted to a substance, let's say drugs or alcohol, that even makes them irrational and do wrong actions and activities continuously, one of the things that you will actually do to help them, to support them, is to cut off the alcohol, cut off the drugs from them. And I think this is what we need to engage in. It's a moral choice to say, we actually love you. We love you, and because of we love you, we cannot allow you to continue in this path, because this path is not just destroying the Palestinians. It is ultimately going to destroy you as well. And so part of what we need to engage in is how do we fully agree with you. We need to engage in actions and activities that are nonviolent, but come again from the heart of love instead of the heart of hatred. What happened to me was that I continued to participate in these nonviolent protests. And for the media or for the camera, when you look at it, it looks the same action. It's the same protest. But the heart and the spirit that I come with is completely different than having a heart and spirit of anger and hatred, but having a spirit of love and compassion. So the action doesn't change, but what is the root of that action changes. And it's very important, I think, for all of us, when we engage in this language about boycott, divestment, and sanction, we say this message. Because the counter to this message is you have many Israeli leaders, sadly, that are trying to completely dilute this message of boycott, divestment, and sanctions by declaring it as a message to delegitimize not Israel, but the Jewish community itself. And this is something very wrong, and we need to make statements saying this is not what we are about.
Sammy, hi. Thanks for a wonderful account. And I just wonder if you could comment. Jesus' commandment to love our neighbor as ourself, we so often, I believe, misinterpret as love thy neighbor as you love yourself. Whereas I think there's a message in there about loving our neighbor as ourself because our neighbor is ourself. I wonder if you could offer a thought.
Yes, exactly. And I believe this is the message, again, of loving the enemy. It is about this oneness. It is about creating this new identity, this new family where there is no us and them anymore. When you resolve your conflict with somebody, when you sign a peace agreement with somebody, at the end of the day, there is still the us and the them. So this is why Jesus does not call us to resolve conflicts. He calls us to love them, which is creating oneness with them. And this is a challenge. This is a real challenge for all of us. What are we doing to truly love and create this oneness? I think for most Christians, we think of it as loving them if they keep on their side and we keep on our side. They do their thing and we do our thing. This is not what the message of Jesus is about. Jesus calls us to actually proactively go and knock on their door and say, I love you. What can we do to become one family together? This idea of separation is not love at all. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for your wonderful talk. It was very inspiring. And I was wondering what... You sound so free because of what the process you described. So can you tell us something about what happens when you're loving your enemy who doesn't want to be loved by you, and how you can turn your love for your enemy into a dialogue with your enemy when what they want to do is hate you, if you like. They haven't gone through necessarily that liberation that you've been through.
Well, sadly, I would say that when you engage in nonviolence, when you engage in loving actions like this, you should probably not expect the other to respond immediately in the same kind to you. But I think this is part of the process. This is what we are called to do. I think the challenge for us is, are we ready to trust the power of love to engage in this work? To understand that this is what we are called to do, this is what we are commanded to do, no matter what. And again, Jesus does not call us to love them when they love us, or, you know, to engage in a process that would lead to love between us and them. We are called simply to love them. And I think in all of us, I would say at the end of the day, we need this love, because this is where the liberation truly exists. And this is where healing truly exists. And it's not, as I said, it's not easy. I mean, we have voices within our context of the conflict that loudly and publicly call for the ethnic cleansing of the non-Jews from this land. Do I marginalize them? Do I not engage with them? Do I engage with peace activists, Israeli peace activists? Do we create this oneness in this community between us and Israeli peace activists that we together then can address the voices of the extremists? And I think part of what Jesus teaches us is that actually, I actually believe this point, I think Jesus was a great strategist as well. He wasn't just a spiritual person who was floating over the earth. He understood that love is a means to achieve results and to achieve goals. And part of the liberation process is to look at how can we, as Palestinians and Israelis, committed to peace, committed to nonviolence, engage together now in addressing those who are causing violence. And one thing that's also very important is that Jesus does not give us space to allow the injustice to continue. When he calls us, you have the power to rebuke the sin of others. We need to be able to stand and say the truth as it is. And to those who are committing violence, we need to tell them that you are committing violence. There is no justification, there is no excuse, there is no acceptance of violence to continue. But again, how do we do that as a strategy, as a step that ultimately can reach the hearts of even the most difficult ones? Thank you.
Thank you, Sammy. That was great. I think the warmth of the applause when you finish just will show how much people appreciated your talk. But I think we should show Sammy again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before you disappear, I know someone wants to just mention a couple of events also going on next to each other.
I want to mention one thing as well,
okay,
because we have information here. One of the most important things, especially for the Christian community to do, is to come and learn and to engage in a discussion on how do we as Christians deal with the theology of what happens in the Holy Land. As you know, there are many Christian views as to whose land it is, whose right it is for, what should happen to the people there, what is God's vision for this land. And so one thing I want to invite you is to come and pick a brochure here for a conference called Christ at the Checkpoint, which will be conducted next year in March. And we invite as many of you to come to this conference. So please come and help yourself to this. And we'll have these brochures located in different places as well.